It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we take an in-depth look at the early days of the Ebola outbreak to try to get answers about why the virus spread.
First, we're digging into some of the latest news in the upcoming presidential election of 2016.
This morning, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee announced he's running as a Republican candidate for president in 2016. Yesterday, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson and former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina both announced their bids for the Republican Party's presidential nomination.
Here to talk about the news and where we stand now in terms of presidential candidates is Harry Enten. He's a senior political analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, let's start with some of the latest news. Mike Huckabee entering the race. I think he's sixth in the field right now. Is this news a surprise?
No, I mean, Huckabee has for months, once he left Fox News, which was a very lucrative contract for him, it was pretty clear that he was heading towards a bid, and now he's just made it official, which is nice because he gets this nice announcement and we get to talk about it, but no, it's not a surprise at all.
So last time we saw him in this position, 2008, can we expect a rerun of that, or will there be an essential game-changing narrative here for Huckabee?
To me, it doesn't look like there's going to be much of a game-changer, because remember last time around, what he was able to do was he went to Iowa, which has a very large born-again evangelical Christian vote, won the Iowa caucus, and then ran in New Hampshire, where born-again evangelicals make up less than a quarter of the vote, and ran into a brick wall. And all the polling we see and all the rhetoric we're hearing from Mike Huckabee suggests that he's going to basically rerun the exact same campaign that failed him in 2008. The big difference between now and then is the fact that there are going to be a number of other candidates who are going to be competing for that born-again evangelical block, including Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. So to me, it might actually turn out to be a less successful strategy than it was in 2008.
Right, and given that, I mean, Huckabee must see the same numbers that you and I see, not to get inside his head, but can you get inside his head for us and tell me what he might be thinking about wanting to do this all over again in 2008?
Mike Huckabee is one of the best television personalities I've ever seen. You know, he can go on the air and he can convince you of anything. He could convince an atheist that God exists in 5 seconds if he really wanted to. And I honestly believe he thinks he can go on television. Debates played a huge role in 2012. And maybe he can convince some people who were not convinced in 2008 that he can win. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, Mike Huckabee is the type of guy, if there's anybody who could do it, to be him. And I think he has a lot of faith in his skills. And we're going to see if that faith is going to pay off. I don't think it will, but maybe it will.
So in 2016, the pack is already quite large. I don't know if everyone who's planning has entered. Well, Governor Scott Walker is not entered yet. We know that. So is there a chance that these numbers could work to Huckabee's favor? Maybe split the field, and in 2016, he comes out looking better this time.
Well, you know, it's one of those things, right, where if you look at Huckabee's ideology, it really is in the center, if you were to push everything together, in the center of the Republican Party. And to me, that, in fact, plays against him, because what we're seeing isn't, you know, a number of moderates that are running, like, let's say, you know, Jeb Bush or Chris Christie pretty much has no chance of winning. We're not seeing a bunch of moderates leaving one evangelical Christian or someone who could appeal to that block. What, in fact, we're seeing is a lot of people who appeal to that exact block that Huckabee did well among. And that, to me, in fact, forecasts disaster potentially for him. But, of course, Huckabee has been at this game for a long time, so he can overcome odds and, you know, he can get on those debates and sound better than those other people. But there are going to be a lot of people who look a lot like Mike Huckabee in terms of appealing to religious conservatives. The only place where Huckabee might be different is he has much more of an economic populist position, which could help him do well among, you know, middle class or even working class Republican voters. But to me, the numbers just aren't really there.
Now, he's not the only one to have jumped into the race recently in the Republican field. Ben Carson, a retired neurosurgeon, also former Hewlett-Packard CEO. Carly Fiorina jumped in yesterday. Now, these two have not, neither one has run for and won public office. So what kind of effect do you see them having?
America is a great place where you can run for president even though you have no chance of winning. And Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina really don't have much of a chance. But what they can do, you know, and Carly Fiorina is going to be the only woman who's going to be running. And if she decides that she's going to bring up women's issues and she's going to force Republicans to look and recognize that, you know, Hillary Clinton is likely going to be the Democratic nominee, you can't talk down to her. If she can bring issues like that to the forefront, bring a businesswoman's perspective, someone who led a major company in the United States, that's a big perspective. Ben Carson has, is someone who really has had his eye focused on Obamacare. That's how he came on the scene in 2013, keeping that debate alive. Issue-specific types of candidacies can be successful. But again, if you look at the numbers over time, if you have never won a political office in the modern era in which caucuses and primaries have decided nominations, most of the people who have not run for political office simply haven't gone anywhere. And the ones that have are people who have real blocks of voters that they could count on. You know, think about Robertson with evangelicals in 1988, or think of, in 1996, Pat Buchanan, who really made an appeal to paleoconservatives, economic populists, people who are against free trade. And Carson nor Fiorina really stands out ideologically, which to me suggests that they're going to have major trouble getting their candidacies off the ground.
Is there a case to be made that Fiorina could peel women voters in particular away from Hillary Clinton, or does that just way oversimplify the way women vote?
I think that is way simplified. I mean, look, we can go back to 2010 when Carly Fiorina ran for the Senate against another woman, Barbara Boxer, and in California and got only 39% of the vote. I mean, if you are going to be a woman, that's great, more power to you, but if you're not talking to women's issues, if you're not going to be on their side of the aisle and talking to the issues that are important to them, then it doesn't really mean anything. I mean, you know, you could be an African American such as Ben Carson, and, you know, that's very important, and obviously the GOP wants to reach out to the African American community, but if you aren't talking about the issues that matter to the African American community, then it means nothing.
Now, both of these candidates, Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina, are candidates that I think you use the phrase vanity candidates. And it's not free to run for president. It costs a lot of money. So essentially, are these candidates, do you think, trying to change the conversation, or is there a different agenda there?
You know, these are two wildly successful people. Ben Carson is a great surgeon. Carly Fiorina worked her way up in the business world, and all the power to them. I think in the case of Carson, there's certainly talk, you know, if you talk to some people, that he's more interested in getting a nice television show for him at the end of the campaign. And if you do successful in presidential campaigns, Mike Huckabee is an example of someone who did successful in 2008 and got himself a Fox News show. Carly Fiorina, I don't really know, to be honest with you. I mean, most people look back at her time at Hewlett-Packard and don't think that she did that good of a job. And, you know, she ran in 2010 for the Senate and really didn't do that well of a job in California. And I think it's just sort of the next logical step for people who are successful. And they figure, you know, I got a number of people who are telling me I can do this. But in a country that is as large and as populous as the United States, you're going to find a number of people who can tell you can win president. But the fact of the matter is you're not going to be able to.
We're talking right now with Harry Enten from 538.com about the latest candidates in the 2016 presidential race. Jumping over to the Democrats now, we had Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders announcing that he's running for the Democratic nomination. Where do you put his odds right now?
Oh, good old Bernie Sanders. He, a fine movie actor. He starred in one movie or had a supportive role in 1999. I think he played a rabbi. And he's a successful senator. He's not going anywhere in this race. So he's going to bring liberal issues to the forefront. He may make Hillary Clinton move somewhat to the left. But Hillary Clinton is the most dominant non-incumbent front runner that we've seen in the modern era. And there's no reason to believe that Bernie Sanders, someone who is to the left of the Democratic Party as a whole, has no relationship really with minority groups that would be necessary to topple Clinton in the way that Obama was able to put together very liberal voters and African-Americans in his 2008 run. Sanders just doesn't have those connections. Sanders is going to be a voice. He'll get into the debates. He'll, you know, make Hillary Clinton answers to some issues where perhaps the base doesn't really like her, but overall his chances are slim to nil.
And given Hillary's dominance in the field, it makes you ask the question, you know, again, why is he running? But Max Ehrenfreund of the Washington Post recently made the case that Sanders could be successful not by just going left of Hillary, but by going for moderate working class voters more to Hillary's right. What do you think of that argument?
The writer of whom you just quoted is more than happy to hold that opinion. In my opinion, Bernie Sanders really doesn't have much of an appeal to the center of the electorate. He has been the most liberal United States senator for a long time running. I mean, he is someone who has at times identified as a socialist. And I just don't see it. Someone like Jim Webb, who, you know, will make his campaign if he ultimately decides to run more about working class white voters, may be able to have some success, and the two of them can team up and make Clinton perhaps focus on different issues that she might otherwise do, and if she didn't have competition, just be looking towards a general. But in terms of either one of them having really much of a chance of being able to beat Clinton, I don't really see it. if Clinton becomes so vulnerable that you can't win the nomination, what you'll likely see is somebody besides these two jump into the race and perhaps be able to topple Clinton. But neither Bernie Sanders nor Jim Webb really have much of a chance of defeating Clinton.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political analyst for 538. He was with us to talk about the latest candidates in the 2016 presidential race. The world's worst Ebola outbreak on record dominated headlines last year.
Thousands of people died in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and some American politicians considered travel bans and quarantines in the U.S.
The outbreak has faded from the headlines, but the question remains as to how the spread of the virus got out of control in the first place.
In a new documentary, Frontline traces the spread back to its beginning and reports the mistakes that were made along the way. Here with us now is Frontline producer and director of the documentary Outbreak, Dan Edge. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, before we get into the history here, let's look at today, the Ebola outbreak. It's faded from the headlines. Does that mean it's done, it's contained, we don't need to worry about it now?
No, it's far from over. There are still cases in Guinea and Sierra Leone. Still, if we were looking at this outbreak as it is right now compared to all previous Ebola outbreaks, it would be, you know, what is unfolding right now is still the worst in history. Liberia has done really well to get its case count down to zero, but we're still quite a long way from the end, I think.
What are the priorities today in terms of confronting the virus as it stands now?
Right now, the priorities are twofold. They are getting down to zero. And the three countries have done really well in bending the curve, in stopping that rate of acceleration, which made it so horrific last fall. It's definitely moving in the right direction now, but those last few cases, getting it down to zero, are in many ways the most difficult because they're in those communities that are hardest to reach, hardest to educate. That's priority number one. Priority number two, officials, you know, as we made this film, told me time and time again, is looking forward to sort of a post-outbreak world, both in these three countries, but also all over the developing world, and trying to strengthen health systems so that these outbreaks can be spotted quicker. Because a huge reason that this outbreak became the worst in the world's history is because it wasn't spotted quick enough.
And that's the story you tell in the documentary Outbreak. And let's go back to the beginning. Where does the story begin?
The story begins in a small village in the forest region of Guinea, in the jungle, basically. And on Christmas Day in 2013, a 1.5-year-old boy fell sick. And he is thought to be patient zero, the very first case in this outbreak. And I went to that village with my team last year to try and speak to the family and find out more about who infected whom and whether it was spotted or could have been spotted sooner. And when I was there, the children in the village took me by the hand and showed me this tree, a hollow tree, very spooky place, just a few yards from Patient Zero's house. And they told me that they used to hunt bats in that tree. It used to be a roosting place for bats. And, of course, scientists are pretty sure that the animal reservoir for the Ebola virus, where the Ebola virus hides when it's not killing people, is bats. And so the children and the villagers were pretty sure, and some scientists agree, that this tree, this one place, was the origin of all the death and the mayhem and the panic and the fear that we subsequently saw last year.
Now, before doctors and health officials got involved, what was the initial response to the disease from the people it was affecting in that village and then in other areas?
Well, they thought it was a curse. It's a pretty common explanation for unexplained deaths in these villages. These are very remote areas, completely illiterate, very hard to reach in terms of messaging, and hardly anyone has a radio. So they were pretty sure that it was a curse, and they called in a traditional healer. And one of the tragedies of this outbreak, one of the reasons it got out of control so quickly, is the very techniques that traditional healers use to try and heal people and cure communities are in themselves transmitters. You know, there's a lot of touching, a lot of rubbing wounds, and all those techniques actually spread the virus rather than contained it.
Are these places that have any kind of regular contact with a doctor or a health official that might have been an early warning indicator if it had been there?
What we found in Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia, out in the remote areas, is that there is a health system. It's a very fragile health system. You'll very rarely have any access to a trained doctor, but you'll have a local health representative who has the ability and the authority to distribute some really basic medicine. And that kind of exists alongside the traditional healer system. It's quite fascinating, actually, because sometimes the nurse will refer someone to the traditional healer if he doesn't know what's wrong with them, and the traditional healer will refer them back to the nurse if he can't help them. And but the local nurses in this area of Guinea had never heard of Ebola. I mean, the nearest previous outbreak had been thousands of miles away. There's no reason why they would have heard of Ebola. The symptoms look a little similar to cholera or malaria, so it was misidentified, understandably, for quite a long time. In fact, for about 3 months. By the sort of health officials on the ground who came into contact with it.
Talking to Dan Edge, producer and director of the documentary Outbreak, a frontline documentary airing tonight. Now, you also talked to one of the first doctors involved investigating this. How did they finally figure out this was Ebola?
Well, it reached a point where it had actually killed a doctor in Guinea, which is a big moment, and that alerted the capital, and the Ministry of Health and the World Health Organization sent in a team to take blood samples, and my producer Sasha Achille found the disease detective who went into these villages and took blood samples, and that blood sample was sent off to Paris, and then there was a very really terrible, dramatic moment when they were informed, against all expectation, that this was Ebola. This was a disease that no one had ever thought could appear in this part of Africa.
So now it's there, and health officials, international groups are starting to meet. And you spoke with a member of Doctors Without Borders who was part of Guinea's early response. He sat in on daily meetings between the government, the World Health Organization. Here's a little clip of what he had to say.
Those daily meetings were a nightmare. Every day, day after day. Disorganized meeting, no decision taken, no one knowing what they were talking about. WHO people were really not at the level required for the job. Their coordinator never worked on Ebola before, and WHO was really downsizing the scale of the epidemic. Immediately I thought, those people are useless. They don't even understand what they're supposed to do here.
So was this a missed opportunity, Dan, at what could have been a turning point if there'd been a more organized, cohesive effort in places like Guinea?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the saga of this epidemic is unfortunately littered with missed opportunities. And the chaos and the lack of coordination that our interviewees described to us in those early days were critical in the virus getting away. This seems to have been a real misunderstanding about who was in charge. Everyone looked for leadership to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization told me in interviews that's not what they do. They're there to serve the government. So they're to give them advice, and then it's up to the government whether they take that advice or not. And that kind of ambiguity seems to have led to sort of gaps in the response. And Ebola does not forgive gaps in a response. It requires a perfect response.
Talking to officials with the nations, with the World Health Organization, with NGOs, did you hear from anybody, okay, we have learned the lesson we need to learn, next time we're going to have a more cohesive response?
Yeah, no, I heard that time and time again. You know, if there's one positive thing that can come out of this horrific outbreak, it's that there are lessons that can be learned and applied the next time, because I heard time and time again from officials, the World Health Organization and the CDC, that there will be more of these. There are going to be more of these. The major lessons people wanted to tell us about were, one, strengthening health systems in the developing world, which sounds like, you know, a good moral thing to do, but actually the way it's been explained to me is a sort of practical imperative to do that, because the stronger the health systems in these places, the more likely they are to be able to stop these outbreaks when they start, and the less likely they are to end up on our shores, you know, in the United States and the UK. The other big lesson is that the world wasn't ready, didn't have the capacity to go in and help these countries. There's no big humanitarian health force And that was, you know, very evidently lacking in August and September last year when there were bodies on the streets of Monrovia.
Dan, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dan Edge. He's producer and director of Frontline's Outbreak, a new documentary. The documentary traces the spread of Ebola in West Africa from its earliest stages and as it spread through three West African countries. It airs tonight at 9. You can see that on your local public television station, and we've got a link to information about it over at the Central Time Facebook page. Breaking news this afternoon, state representative and co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, John Nygren, says the public authority proposal in Governor Scott Walker's budget is effectively dead. That proposal would have turned the University of Wisconsin system into a public authority with more autonomy.
WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson is with us to talk about that story. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this public authority option sounds like the chapter is closed. What happened today?
Yeah, there were no votes taken on anything with the university in the Joint Finance Committee today, but what happened was as good as a vote. You had the co-chairs of the Budget Committee, Representative John Nygren, Senator Alberta Darling, had a little briefing with reporters, as they often do, before their meeting today, and they led off their briefing by saying, "This proposal is dead. We're not going to support it in this budget." They had some nice things to say about it, said it's definitely worth discussion. It's something we ought to look at. But they said in no uncertain terms that it was not going to be part of this budget. And so, you know, that's one big piece of the governor's budget that is now off the table.
Now, this news does not come entirely as a surprise. Lawmakers have been expressing reservations about the public authority model for quite a while now. But did they give a final reason as to why they effectively said no?
Ultimately, they said it's just a pretty big change and that they wanted to have a more in-depth conversation about it. You know, I think you've heard it really should be no surprise today that they ultimately said they were going to take it out of the budget, because there have been hints for some time now that this issue was going to have problems in the legislature. I mean, as soon as the governor introduced it, you had Republican lawmakers saying they didn't like the amount of autonomy that it gave to the UW, so they didn't necessarily trust the UW with that freedom, especially when it came to raising tuition. Then the governor changed the plan and put limits on the UW to raise tuition. And so the freedom that was a part of this UW authority was already limited in the proposal. But, you know, in the end, the fact that they're taking it out at this point in the budget process just shows that there were not the votes for this in the legislature. And, you know, for whatever reason, they had concerns with it.
Now, initially, this was billed as kind of a trade-off, $300 million budget cut over 2 years, but more flexibility in the form of this public authority model. So where does that leave the budget cuts?
And the budget cuts are still there. As of right now, the governor's budget would still cut $300 million over 2 years, $150 million a year. And so that's still the big question mark. The lawmakers said that they are interested in looking at freeing up the UW system from some state procurement requirements that they said could give the UW some savings. And they're also kind of holding out hope that these new revenue estimates that we're going to get probably by the end of this week will show that the state has more money than it originally thought, and it would use some of that money to offset the UW cuts. But as of right now, that cut is still there, and this UW autonomy, UW authority idea that the governor proposed back when he was talking about a budget with bold ideas, this was kind of the centerpiece of that, and the one that he talked about is Act 10 for the UW. That part of the budget is gone.
And Sean, before we let you go, any word from the governor or the university on how this news is going over?
Yeah, I've been wrapped up in, you know, the Finance Committee today, talking about other issues, so I haven't heard from them directly. I think that they've known, at least the governor's office has known, that this is going to be coming for some time now, so it shouldn't be too big of a shock. The university, there were mixed feelings about this proposal from the get-go, kind of a split between regents who are still on the Board of Regents from, you know, Jim Doyle appointees and Walker appointees. But a lot of people within the university system, especially people who work there, didn't like this idea.
Sean, thanks a lot for catching us up.
You're welcome.
That was WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson with us to talk about the news that the Joint Finance Committee has said that the public authority option for the University of Wisconsin system is effectively dead.
Zoe, here's the deal. Peter's always been a girlfriend guy. He put all his focus and energy into his relationships, and all his dude friends just fell by the wayside.
Zoe, don't listen to him, all right? I mean, we're 8 years apart. Barely grew up together in the same house.
This is ridiculous. Why is it weird that I had girlfriends?
Nothing. We're just saying you never really had a best friend is all.
It's Paul Rudd and friends starring in the movie I Love You, Man, billed as a bromantic comedy about a groom-to-be in search of a best friend and a best man. Male friendships aren't always the stuff movies are made of. According to our next guest, men have a harder time opening up to other men and sharing true intimacy in their friendships because of long-standing ideas of what it means to be a man.
Robert Garfield is the author of The Male Code, Unlocking the Power of Friendship. He says men are missing out on a lot when they don't have the skills to invest in meaningful, open friendship with other men. He's with us now. Dr. Garfield, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, you've looked closely at friendships between men and what it can mean to their relationships with their partners, their kids, and to their health as well. What are men missing out on when they don't have emotionally intimate friendships with other men?
Well, they're missing out on a lot, and the costs are great. A lot of research tells us that men do better with close friendships. First of all, they do better with their own health. When they have close friends, they're reminded to take care of themselves. And when they don't, they oftentimes slide, you know, the tendency for guys to be tough and go it alone when nobody, they're not talking to anybody about this, causes them to make fewer doctor's appointments every year, get late diagnoses, more complications. And the other big problem has to do with their relationships. If they don't have guys to talk to, a lot of the times they get into trouble in their own marriages. They don't talk about it, and they just withdraw in these situations. Contributes to the fact that 2 out of every 3 marriages today are initiated by women whose chief complaint is he's not emotionally available. So good friends really can help in that way.
You say this long-standing concept of what men are, the male code, is a big part of why men have trouble connecting in friendships with other men. What is this male code?
Well, the male code is a set of social guidelines that defines how men are supposed to feel and act. And when you check, the code has been enforced for nearly 200 years, and it really hasn't changed much. You know, it's associated with a kind of set of behaviors that includes emotional restraint and withholding personal information, trying to be in control, competition, and physical toughness. And it's some of this today. You played the that little clip from one of my favorite movies, I Love You, Man, at the beginning of the show. It seems silly by today's standards for men to just so rigidly hold to those things. But it's actually been kept in place by sort of a carrot and a stick model. For men who followed the code, you know, they've been able to sort of maintain power and privilege and prestige over the years. But boy, those who don't follow it can be in real trouble, bullying on the playground if you don't conform to the masculinity, the code of that. So it stayed in place a lot longer than it needs to be. But it's not working now for a lot of reasons because of changes in the culture.
Now, you surveyed hundreds of men and found out that, in general, they seem to be satisfied with the number of friendships that they do have, but they want them to be closer. So what is it that's standing in the way of closer friendships between men?
Well, we were actually surprised in the research that we did, which we launched in 2012, and we are just, you know, looking at the because we found that actually undercover, we call it the quiet revolution, that guys are actually opening up to each other much more than we thought, but they haven't gone public about it. And largely that's because the male code is still in place. But when you talk to men who have closer friendships and they don't advertise them, they're actually talking more these days about what they're really feeling. They just haven't gone public about it because it doesn't feel exactly safe. You know, as we see in the movies, the culture is still behind the times, sort of making fun of the kinds of depth in relationships that men are really wanting to have. But they're actually starting to talk to each other more. That's what we found out in our survey.
So supposing a man out there is listening and thinking, yeah, this is me. I want these closer friendships. I'm afraid of being mocked or shut down if I try to do this. What's the first step? How do they open that door?
Well, one of the things that we found is that guys do much better in person than they do in groups. So you can go to a bar on the weekend, you know, downtown Madison, and see a lot of guys yupping it up with each other and have no clue that one-on-one with some of these relationships, they're having a completely different conversation. And because in-depth conversations really are meant to be private, guys do much better when they're one-on-one with their buddies. And a lot of the times they're just simply afraid to bring things up for no really good reason. But the men that we work with, when we really kind of nudge them to take some risks with their guy friends, they find that there's a whole world full of men out there who want to talk in more openness, you know, just like them. So it's really a new world for men when they actually start talking to the men that they already know that they haven't really brought up these things with.
We're talking right now with Robert Garfield. He's a psychotherapist and a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of The Male Code. We're hearing the case for why men benefit from close, nurturing friendships with other men.
And we want to hear from you. If you're a guy, do you have this kind of open, intimate friendship with other men? How did you get there? Or do you want that and you're not sure how to make it part of your life? Or are you skeptical of the whole notion? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're talking male friendship today. Our guest says the men he surveyed want closer relationships with their male friends. We're talking with Robert Garfield, psychotherapist and the author of The Male Code.
And we want to hear from you if you are one of these guys we're talking about. Do you wish you had closer relationships with your male friends? What's standing in your way? Or do you have this kind of friendship? Or if you're someone who knows a man, what's your observation? Do they make these connections? Do they allow this kind of emotional intimacy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. We've got John on the line in McFarland. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a friend like that. We actually just spent the opening fishing weekend in Hayward together. I guess the governor was up there too this weekend, but we have that kind of relationship. We drove up and back together. It takes about 4.5 hours. We talk or text each other, even if we're just driving by each other's houses. We try to write a text before we get there. We don't text and drive, but we try to write a text before we get there that says RBH, and that means a roll by high. And we just have a really good friendship, and it's developed over a number of years, about 5 years. Different times we needed to help each other, and we've come through for each other, and so it's just become a really good friendship.
John, I got to ask, I mean, when you're talking, is it all about the fishing, or do you talk about, you know, the personal problems, the issues in your lives? Do you share that kind of stuff?
I think he would say, too, that we find it beneficial to talk about everything. We've had each of us has had different challenges in the last several years, so we usually talk about those things.
John, thanks a lot for sharing those thoughts. Robert, is this a good model? Is this a model that you're hearing from some of the guys you're talking to?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that John's, you know, sort of story highlights is how guys tend to find each other and tend to develop close friendships through activities. You know, it's not just the phone call, but kind of being out and doing things together. And also where there's a private space allows for a venue for, you know, topics to develop. And men, you know, like John and his friend, you know, over a period of years, because, of course, it takes a while for trust to develop, so not everything comes out all at once. You know, the first fishing trip probably didn't get into talking about what's going on in his marriage or how things are going with his kids. But in those kinds of settings there, if men will take a little bit of a risk and start to mention something about what's going on that's important to them, they find that their friends will come and meet them. And that's the beginning of a good friendship. It takes time.
I'm curious what you think about the word bromance. It hit popular currency in our culture maybe a year ago. I'm not hearing it quite as much now, but you know, given that you write that one of the obstacles to friendships between men can be sort of homophobia, what do you think about that word and that issue?
Well, I think that humor has been a real protection for guys. I mean, if you take a look at the shows on television about friends, you know, there's a lot of kind of dopiness and humor that would make you think, is this somebody I would really want to talk to? It's almost as though we have to sort of go to the opposite end to make things so light when really they're that important. So at this stage of the game, a lot of the really important things are sort of wrapped up in humor to make it seem a little more palatable and a little lighter. It's one of the reasons that I actually liked the movie, that you guys played, because it really showed, even though there was a lot of humor in it, it really showed the difficulties that men often do encounter. The homophobia is one thing. A lot of the times, the machismo aspects of it, I'm thinking of a situation, if I can share this with you. I was with my best friend today. We were walking down by the River Drive in Philadelphia, and we remembered a couple years ago when we were walking down there, and I had my sort of arm around him, and we were talking about something that was going on that was hard in his life, and a car pulled up, teenagers, and just started yelling at us with expletives, homophobic expletives, and then sort of pulled off, and he and I just looked at each other, and we cracked up. I mean, we're both straight white males on one hand. And then on the other hand, I started feeling a little bit bad for one of my guy friends who's gay, has to sort of put up with that probably all the time, then. So there are a lot of obstacles that men really do have to deal with, prejudices, social prejudices. Do we look like we're manly enough when we want to be close with each other?
Talking to Dr. Robert Garfield, author of Breaking the Male Code, about the power of male friendships. Back to our callers now. We've got Jake on the line in Waukesha. Jake, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What you want to bring up, Jake?
Well, what I've noticed now and kind of what I fear for future generations is that I don't see a lot of kids, little boys that have a best friend. And I'll be 35 years old this month, and my best friend I've known for 33 years. And, we've gone through everything from job changes to moves. In fact, I just moved him into a new house that's a little further away. But just to say, your best friends are the ones that help you move.
Jake, I'm going to jump in. Don't have a great connection there, but Dr. Garfield, he's had a friend for 30-plus years. He sees younger boys not having that best friend. Is this a generational thing that maybe could get worse over time?
I don't know if it's a generational thing, but the research certainly shows that, young children, boys certainly, as young children, having close friends is really, really critical for development. I mean, we know that friendships in general for kids predict school performance. They predict social success and later success in life too. So it's a really critical thing for boys to have. And in our research, the thing we found that was interesting was that when boys could observe their own fathers having close friendships, that they themselves were more likely to have close friendships themselves. So that the work that parents do with their kids in terms of facilitating them developing friendships is really key. Play dates, sure, you have kids, you've seen that, the importance of getting them together. Because kids naturally do make friends. I mean, it's really shown from the time they're actually in nursery school that kids will find each other. They will find people who are their friends even at that early age. So absolutely, you know, being able to develop that kind of closeness is critical for young kids. We need to pay attention to that as parents.
Dr. Garfield, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Robert Garfield is a psychotherapist and a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the book, The Male Code.
Little challenge to throw your way from the organizers of the Great American Grump Out. That's coming up tomorrow. Organizers are challenging us to take 24 hours, starting tomorrow, to be completely free of being grumpy, crabby, or rude.
Well, we're telling you a day early, so you have time to muster your resources, plan your strategy, and go to your happy place, no matter how much your life stinks tomorrow.
I'm going to be off the show tomorrow. That's going to make it easy, Veronica, for you to be happy tomorrow, right?
That's almost too easy. That feels like cheating.
No way.
So I guess I can wait till you get back on Thursday to take a swing at being grump-free.
So I guess we'll see if tomorrow the world feels like a happier, better place, or just business as usual. I think I'll take the opposite approach. I'll spend my day off being really surly and grumpy, but I'll isolate myself from humanity so they don't bear the brunt of it all.